I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're here in Las Vegas, broadcasting from the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. And as you all know, there are 8 Democrats running for president, 9 Republicans. And even though it's more than a year before the election, they've all been asked a lot of tough questions about the Iraq War, national security, poverty, health care, gay rights. But one candidate has repeatedly been asked a question no other has had to answer. Is he black enough? Now, 100 years ago, this would have been a ridiculous question. According to the arithmetic of American slavery, one drop of African blood was enough to consign a man or woman to the oppression that characterized black life. So perhaps it's a sign of progress that we now have the luxury of asking if someone is black enough, or is the question inherently offensive? But even if it is offensive, does it speak to something important and real about what the black community wants and expects from its leaders as these leaders achieve unprecedented levels of visibility and power? Here to talk about this, Cornell Belcher, advisor and pollster for the Obama for America campaign, Mary Mitchell, editorial board member and columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Kevin Merida, associate editor of the Washington Post and co-editor of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Welcome, and thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Mary Mitchell, I'd like to start with you. How long has Barack Obama been answering this question?
Actually, the question was asked when Barack Obama was running to be a U.S. representative. When he ran against Bobby Rush in Hyde Park area, people were asking him, or at least there was a whispering campaign, that Barack Obama, because he is Harvard-educated, light-skinned, grew up in Hawaii, lived in Indonesia, what does he know about representing people in the 2nd District? It was a question that was asked. So it's the same question, is he black enough? Only now we are paying attention to it. And I don't think people paid attention to it when it was asked during his first campaign.
But in fairness, was the question being asked by his political opponents, or was it an authentic sort of grassroots question?
Well, both. One, the opponents will exploit the question, is he black enough? And in this campaign, here was a state representative who was fearful that you have this very charismatic person who comes from a different background than political activists or what we think of as a grassroots political activist. He's running against an opponent who can say, I was a Black Panther. And how are you going to defeat a guy like that? And what Bobby Rush did, and I think he did, it was brilliant on his part, because he really won that race handily, because he brought up the is he black enough thing. And that's what they whispered. Does he play Bid Whist, for God's sake? That's what they were asking.
Oh, that's interesting. Kevin Merida, when people ask that, what do you think they're really asking?
Well, I think they're asking that when push comes to shove, are you going to say you're black and black first?
I want to hear more about that, but I want to bring Cornell Belcher in. So hold that thought for me and expand a little bit more on it, if you would. Cornell Belcher, is this generational or is this personal? Does any black politician who came of age after the civil rights movement, who's seeking a position of leadership, have to answer this at some point? Or is this personal, sparked by unique characteristics of Barack Obama's biography, that he's biracial, that he was raised in Hawaii, etc.? What do you think?
There is a generational thing going on here where you have a group of younger African-American leaders coming up now who are not a part of the civil rights movement. They're more likely to be just as comfortable in the executive board meeting. I mean, they came, quite frankly, as Barack says, I'm standing on the shoulders of the civil rights movement. And I think some of what we see is the tension between a break from the civil rights leadership that we're also proud of and that we're building on to a newer generation of people who, quite frankly, were not part of that struggle but benefited from that struggle. And we're asking the questions, okay, how do you define what is blackness now if you did not come out of civil rights leadership?
Mary Mitchell.
But I also think that it is a cultural question that we're asking. And I think that goes back way before even Booker T. This goes back to when we were divided by our differences. The people who were light-skinned and the people who were mulatto were in the house. They weren't in slavery. They were in the house. They were the ones who were closest to the master. The people who were very dark-skinned, the people who had been denied certain things, they were out in the fields. And so you look today at the way we react to these differences. When we see someone who is well-spoken, someone who is Harvard-educated or Ivy League-educated, when we hear our children say, she's acting white, he's trying to act white, what does that mean? We are back to those differences and dividing ourselves up by differences. So I think that the political part of this in the Barack Obama campaign is that people have exploited that, understanding very well the African-American community and understanding how to put that wedge, as politicians do, how to put that wedge between us.
But, Mary, I have to ask, the people who raised this issue initially on the national scene in connection with this presidential campaign have been African-Americans. It was Stanley Crouch wrote in the New York Daily News, "What Obama Isn't, Black Like Me," was the headline of the column. Deborah Dickerson in Salon wrote that black in our political and social reality means descended from West African slaves. New York Times wrote a piece. It was rooted in a working class neighborhood in Washington, D.C.
Can I jump in for a second?
Please,
I mean,
Cornell
this
Belcher.
Is actually sort of where the chattering class and the pundits and the insiders are disconnected from the voters. Because, you know, you hear this sort of come up among the sort of the pundits and the elitists, and it's a back and forth conversation. But, you know, to Joe Blow and Jane Blow, you know, struggling, in, you know, in South Carolina, one of the early states, they're much more concerned about health care and, you know, what kids are toting around guns than they are about, you know, whether or not someone's black enough.
Does this question offend you? Does it hurt you?
Personally, yes. It is offensive to me that it's almost like the dumbing down of our culture. And we have such a rich culture of so many people bled and died for our children to be able to get a good education, for us to be able to vote, and for us to hold our heads upright, and for us to respect our women and, you know, and build family. And we have sort of in the entertainment industry, you would almost think that they are attacking what historically our people have fought for. So, yeah, to me personally, it is outright offensive.
I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. And thank you for coming. And if you want to ask a question, I'm going to ask you to raise your hand, not because, you know, I'm a control freak, but because we want to get a mic to you.
I'm Gwen Eiffel. Speaking as someone who got my share of fights in elementary school for talking too proper, this resonates with me, and I also find it to be kind of a negative conversation. But what I'm wondering if, and a couple of the panelists have alluded to this, how do we then take this conversation, which is healthy to have, and turn it to something positive, especially among journalists who are, after all, who's in this room? How do we take this argument and make it not so simplistic and not as negative as it has been so far?
Could you elaborate, though? What do you mean by it's a negative conversation?
Well, I think it's a negative conversation when we sit there and we do the simplistic, oh, he's not black enough, and don't take it farther than that. We have in this conversation. But I think that when we leave this room, it is easy to then go out and write stories and have this become part of the storyline without elaborating, without finding a more sophisticated way to explain why it matters or what it tells us about him or about us as a society. And I think that's what's incumbent upon journalists to do it. I'm wondering, how do we do that?
Interesting. Kevin, do you want to start?
I think it's a great question. And I think that people should go out and test this out with real conversations with people and try to dig deeper and find out what are really the fault lines on the question of racial identity.
Jimmy Israel. For me, so much of the question is plantation jibber-jabber. I mean, we've been having the same conversation for hundreds of years about you not black because you live in the master's house, and you too black because you out there in the field. Mm-hmm. So it's plantation jibber-jabber. And the reason we're seeing so much of it in the media, I think it's because the mainstream wants to know what is authentically black. I think we all know we're black. We wake up every morning, we look in the mirror, we wash our face, and we know. We know, but they don't know. They don't know what to call us. They don't know if they should call us the N-word or African-Americans. And there are these black people among us who look to the Cosby paradigm for the ultimate black experience. There are those among us who look to the Jay-Z paradigm for the ultimate black experience. And there's something in between, you know. And we have to move away from this idea that there's a median black experience because, be careful, because that is the black experience that the mainstream will hold you to, you know. So it's not a worthless conversation, but it's almost a worthless conversation.
Mary?
Well, I just wanted to respond to Gwen's first question, because when I had to write columns dealing with this issue, it was a challenge. One is because I had a hard time focusing on the historical context. Yes, when you talk about plantation jibber-jabber, well, that's history. And sometimes you have to understand where you are, you have to go back and see where you came from. And you have to understand the context of why this question comes up. So I think that one of the things that journalists can do a better job of is understanding the history of why we are even having this conversation today and going back and explaining it and giving it analysis.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News, and we're talking about the question of Barack Obama and black identity. We're speaking with Cornell Belcher, advisor and pollster for the Obama campaign, Mary Mitchell, editorial board member and columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Kevin Merida, associate editor of the Washington Post. This gentleman here, and then there was somebody here who had a question over this side. Okay.
Hello, my name is Lee Wack. My question is for Mr. Cornell Belcher and for the rest of the panelists as well. Has there ever been a candidate for president or, I guess, any other major political office that we could consider is black enough, if that's something that we're going to consider, at the same time, has enough to appeal to the rest of the mainstream voting community?
Certainly, I'm a Democrat, but I'm also happen to be an African American. And the truth of the matter is, you know, we have real problems that are unique to our community. When we start talking about building a movement, we're talking about, you know, I sit in, you know, here in focus groups and hear people talk about, you know, how change can't happen, you know, how things have been this bad for so long and they're never going to change. And it breaks my heart because I think we've lost the ideals of movement in our community because Lord knows, I mean, what's worse than slavery or Jim Crow, what have you. And together, we as a people, as a community, came together around that and built a movement that brought about, that sort of bring about change. I mean, I think what Obama says is that, you know, I can't do it alone, but, you know, together sort of we can build a movement, but which I think is quintessentially sort of black. And the truth of the matter is, sir, you know, I registered and voted because of Jesse Jackson's campaign. I think it was a phenomenal movement, and it was something very important sort of in politics.
Is that really true? Did you really register because of Jesse Jackson's campaign?
I got excited about Jesse Jackson's campaign, and I would not be here right now in politics if it were not for that sort of seeing that sort of ideal of change. But we must then progress, and sort of what's the next step of that? And I think whether or not you support Barack or not, whether or not you vote for him or not, you have to see it sort of as a historical step, you know, building on what Jesse, I think, built and sort of taking the next step in sort of viability.
We are now seeing our issues being raised everywhere. And I think that's a good thing.
We want to be sort of gone after. We want to be pursued. We want to be romanced. And I think that you have right now, the beauty of this race is that you have the Democratic Party, you know, fully engaged in trying to romance the black voters in this country. And I think in the end, our communities win.
Hi, my name is Savitra Wilson. I'm a student at Louisiana State University. My question is, will people ever be satisfied? Will someone ever be black enough? I say this because I know when I was growing up, I was always considered black people would stereotype me and say that, you know, I wasn't calling me white girl and things like that. When I came to college, journalism, double major in journalism and history with a focus in African-American history. But now it seems like I'm too black. It's like if you know your history, if you want to talk about your history, and if you're not really talking about what's in the mainstream media, and if you're going against a lot of things that are in the mainstream media, especially since I'm 21 and most of my peers, you know, hip hop, rap, and all those things. And now that if I go against that, now I'm being too black, too criticizing of the black community. Although I never lived, I was working class family. I have family, you know, all in New Orleans places, Calio Projects. And although I've never lived there, I still can relate. And it's like I'm trying to uplift black people, doing things to make black people prosper in life. And I feel like either way you go, you're going to get criticized.
Mary, do you want to speak on that?
I think what has to happen is we have to stop seeing poor black people as that's the standard for blackness.
I want to spend the last couple of minutes giving each of our panelists, if you'd like to, a couple of minutes for a closing thought. And particularly, I would love to hear from the journalists and what's the next question that we should be asking? Kevin Merida.
Well, I like to obey Michelle's orders anytime she gives me orders. But because I think the conversation that we've been having is good. I think there's been an assumption that, you know, is he black enough is like saying he's not black enough. And I want to kind of turn that a little bit because it doesn't mean that he's not black enough. I mean, if we're going to have a discussion, is he black enough, there's kind of a subtle assumption that somehow he's failed that test, whatever that test is. And who's to say he's failed a test? And so I don't think we should use the question kind of as an exhibit, an indictment, you know. I mean, so far from what I've seen him, he's handled it very well. I mean, he's handled that question pretty well, I think. He's answered. He's haven't been too defensive about it. We haven't really talked much about how he's dealt with it, which I think has been fairly remarkable, that the fact that it's been so open a discussion, and from everything I've seen, he's handled it very well.
Okay. Would you like to talk about what questions you want to ask next, or you want that to be your closing thought?
That's my closing thought, and then I'll let the others have.
For now, I'm gonna go to you next, because Mary's our senior diva. I'm going to give her the last word.
All righty.
Well, you know, I don't know what the question is, but I think this is what I hope for. I hope that through this campaign and actually through the part of this debate that we're having right now, that we'll have a world where my two sons will grow up and go to college and be able to speak articulately and raise their families and go out there and pursue their dreams and not ever have to answer the question of whether or not they're black enough.
Thank you.
I would say that our cultural divide did not happen overnight. It certainly didn't happen with the Barack Obama campaign. And hopefully, because we are addressing these questions publicly and talking about it, that we can begin the healing process, I think, that needs to be done so that we don't have to be dividing ourselves up by class, by skin color, by economic status, that we begin to internally close the divide.
I want to thank our panelists, Cornell Belcher, advisor and pollster for the Obama campaign, Mary Mitchell, editorial board member and columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, Kevin Merida, associate editor of the Washington Post and co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas, and I want to thank all of you in our audience for being here and for contributing to this very rich, I think, and spirited discussion, and I just want to thank all of you personally for being part of it. Thank you very much. That was a much abbreviated version of the conversation we recorded yesterday at the National Association of Black Journalists Conference here in Las Vegas. To hear the full 90-minute roundtable, you can visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore.